It's National Ag Week. We check in with South Dakota agriculture leaders and future leaders. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, March 18th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, South Dakota's Secretary of Agriculture and Natural Resources, Hunter Roberts, is with us. We'll talk tariffs and transparency, avian flu, and the upcoming Governor's Conference on Ag. Then we get to know rancher Kelsey Scott from Cheyenne River. We'll focus on ideas like disturbance for soil health, for example, and connection, as in how do women lead conversations around the future of ranching. Then a bit later in the hour, the future farmers of America. Laura Rohde and Wyatt DeYoung join us for a look at how thousands of South Dakota farmers get their start in ag science and leadership. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It is National Ag Day today, a day to celebrate the fewer than 2% of the population who provide food, fiber, and fuel to all of us. I spoke with South Dakota Secretary of Agriculture and Natural Resources Hunter Roberts for a recap of the legislative session, the impact of tariffs on South Dakota ag producers, and what South Dakotans need to know about bird flu. Here's our conversation.
It was the most freshman legislators, I think, in our state's history. So there was some growing pains as we went through that. Generally, I think it was a successful legislative session, but with new folks, kind of, you have to work a little bit harder than normal just to kind of that learning process for all of us, meeting new people and them learning the way the process works and learning the issues is not always easy. But generally, we had a good legislative session. You know, from the agriculture perspective, we always look for do no harm. I think we did a pretty good session. We look at that. The department had a few bills. All our bills passed. There was some changes to our confined animal feeding operation fee that we were proposing to increase. That got slimmed down a little bit, but we'll keep our folks working to permit and make sure that our feeding operations are in environmental compliance. Additionally, we helped the industry pass Senate Bill 14, which strengthens our protections for agriculture production facilities against agroterrorism and biosecurity risk, which we think was very important to kind of take that step. There's been a few other states do that. Fortunately, these facilities have not been a terrorism target to date, but certainly want to put the protections in place ahead of time before any risk could come about.
Let's talk about that a little bit so people understand the role of transparency that intersects with that, because part of the criticism is if operations become more secretive, then we can't check in on regulations or environmental protections, for example, and yet the desire to protect from any kind of terrorism activity. And what are some of the protections so that there is transparency in agriculture to the press and to the people?
Well, anytime we do and when you look at kind of the animal side of it, the CAFO side of it, the confined animal feeding operation side of it, if they're to that stage, they need a permit through the Department of Ag and Natural Resources. So we permit these to make sure they follow the rules and regulations of our state and federal government when it comes to discharges and environmental impacts. That is a public process that's public notice through the department. Traditionally, they're public notice through a conditional use permit that they need in their counties as well. So that's an open process. We publish it. And also, anytime someone wants to review a permit, usually these are hundreds, sometimes thousands of pages long, these permits, they can come to the office and peer here and review them. So that's an open public process. They can come see them anytime. What we have concerns with when it comes to the security side of things is putting out a list with a searchable GIS database or addresses that would make them much easier for someone to target. So we think there's a balance there. Currently in law, we do have some protections for that to kind of not put out this big form. If you look at the department's website, we do have a map that includes CAFOs across the state. Right now, I think we have 437 of them, and list where they are in each county, or kind of that they're in each county. Mm-hmm. But when you get down in the weeds of specific locations, we think that we don't want to put a target on these facilities, but we also want to be open and transparent. So, I mean, if you have a facility in a county you want to look for, give us a call. You can come here and we'll walk you through what's in the permit and show you kind of the way that where they exactly are. If you want to look at each one, that is available in the department.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about Ag Week going forward. What are some of the things that should be on people's radar?
Well, just, you know, myself, I'm thankful for our ag producers in our state that get up every day and go out and help feed the world. Agriculture is our biggest industry in South Dakota. Last I saw, about 8 times bigger than the next largest industry. So it's a very big economic driver for our state as well. You know, those producers, they sell their crop, they sell their livestock, they sell their commodities, and then they come to town and invest that money on Main Street to keep their operations going. So it's a huge economic driver. I think roughly 130,000 people are employed through agriculture in South Dakota. So it's just a huge economic driver for our state. And, you know, myself and the department, we're certainly thankful for all those producers that go out there and get it done for us every day.
Yeah. They are facing some tough times. And one of the things that's always difficult in ag is a change in administration, because there might be regulations that are now going to disappear that were Biden era regulations, but yet we're also facing the uncertainty of Trump tariffs and the impact that will have on South Dakota ag producers, which they remember from 2016. But there are some differences this year. What are you hearing about from farmers and producers about the transition, and particularly about the prospect of tariffs and their impact on South Dakota ag?
Well, anytime in business you have unknowns, it's a concern. You know, our producers deal with it every day when it comes to drought, natural disasters, things like that. But when it comes to tariffs, the unknown is definitely a concern. I think it has alleviated a little bit back when President Trump, his first term, when there was a trade war with China, there was some economic assistance for our producers that helped them kind of work through that. So, and Secretary Rollins has said she's open for doing that again. So that creates a little less risk. But anytime you look at this world stage and are rolling in tariffs, there could be winners and losers. Who wins, who loses is definitely a concern for our producers. But also, generally, I think our ag community is in support of President Trump and moving forward with ways to make our country stronger.
Yeah. They don't want the economic assistance. They want the markets, though. Is there a place for pushback? Are they, like, where is that line between? Because I remember last time we were talking about this and a lot of people were saying just what you said there. We support this president. We have faith in his ability as a negotiator. But this is starting to hurt. And we really don't want the economic assistance. What we want is the markets. Some of those markets never came back from the first trade war with China. Where's the point for pushback against a president that you might support in other areas, but that is, you know, giving your business and your economic future on your land a bit of a migraine?
Well, I think we need patience first. I mean, it seems like this tariff discussion is an ever-evolving thing. You know, I don't know what's going to be the next tariff out there or the next delay in tariffs. It's just very hard to keep track of this stuff. Generally, we got to have a product to sell. So at my farm, I'm focusing on ways to make my property, make my crops, my livestock more profitable going forward. So I think we need to have patience to start with and figure out kind of what the impacts are and take it from there. Ways to push back. I think it's a very challenging right now because it's, like I said, it's an ever evolving situation.
Right. Yeah, you have to push back against something specific, not against a broad swath of news headlines coming across your phone every day. Yeah.
Certainly there's going to be winners and losers too.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at kind of, you know, it's definitely agriculture is such a huge impact on our state mm-hmm. that some industries in our agriculture community might benefit from tariffs and some probably will not. And some might not be changed, and definitely some will will be negatively impacted, like we saw in China, the last time soybeans took a beating, and it hasn't returned quite as much as it was back then.
Another big thing on people's minds is bird flu. Give us an overall picture of what's happening in the industry across the state now, especially for larger producers.
So far this year, knock on wood, 2025 hasn't been impacted yet, but looking at videos, I see a lot of snow geese moving around, and it seems like the snow geese are the biggest vector that transfers it into South Dakota. When they commute through South Dakota, it seems like that's when we have our impacts. So last late December, snow geese were headed south. We had some pretty big impacts in our state. Thus far this year, it's been very low. But I fear that in the next couple of weeks, we could be back to seeing some impacts. Best ways to address this for now are biosecurity. Certainly our ag producers in the poultry industry are doing a very good job with their biosecurity implementation. But still, it seems like there's been some breakthrough of rents that is concerning. Anytime this impacts us, it's a disaster for our producers. Very trying, very expensive for the federal government and our taxpayers too. Because when we have these large outbreaks, the federal government right now is helping support those producers by paying for that depopulation and reimbursing for the cost of those birds.
And we're not, to be clear, do I understand you, like we're not seeing that in South Dakota so far in 2025, but you think it's approaching? Help me understand
Yes. Exactly
what we're measuring. So nobody's depopulating flocks right now as we record this.
No, we haven't had any large depopulation of birds this year as in 2025 that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But like I said, now that the snow geese are moving around, I think historically, when we see the snow geese move through, that's when we're impacted. So yeah. I fear we might see them soon, certainly hoping not. What's different about this year is the spread that we've seen in kind of the central part of the nation more so, where it impacts more egg layers, which has definitely impacted our everyone's pocketbook when you buy eggs at the store.
So help us understand, and I'm trying to get my mind around not being someone who grew up on a farm. Would I be in the business of both layers and fryers, or are those two different operations? Do people do one or the other, or do some people do both?
Some people do both,
okay.
Usually not in the same location.
Okay.
We're a little unique in South Dakota because of our Hutterite colonies, where you'll see, I mean, generally our poultry population is turkeys, and then we have Dakota layers up by Flandreau. That's a big egg laying facility.
Okay.
So those are our big facilities. But at our Hutterite colonies, a lot of times they'll do a little bit of everything. So there'll be some egg layers there. There will be some broilers on the chicken side as well, and then the turkeys.
Okay. And so are there vaccines? You mentioned biosecurity. Is that vaccination? Is that something else? Help me understand how this works. How do you prepare and prevent?
So biosecurity is making sure that we're not cross-contaminating things. So it's hot washing vehicles that enter facilities, Tyvek suits, keeping things very clean and keeping things out. So you're putting up netting, you're sealing up things. So birds or mice or things like that might be carrying the flu can't get in.
Okay.
When it comes to vaccines, there is some research going on in vaccines. Last I heard, there's a company that's pretty close, partnered up with Medgene out of Brookings in HPAI vaccine for dairy cattle. When you get into the poultry side of things, it's much more complicated. The vaccines, implementing the vaccine, how do you do that in baby chicks and things like that? It gets much more complicated, and there's certainly trade issues when it comes to that as well that has held up USDA and FDA's research into these vaccines.
Okay. All right. Anything else?
Well, I'd be remiss without mentioning that coming up in June 17th and 18th in Deadwood, we have the Governor's Ag Summit. It's a free event to attend. We're working very hard to get world thought leaders, definitely U.S. thought leaders when it comes to agriculture, to help educate our ag community and folks interested in ag. It's always a fun event that we enjoy hosting. Governor Roden will be there kicking off. He's planning on taking a more active role this year now that he's governor. So we're definitely excited about that. Like I said, in Deadwood, June 17th and 18th, registration is available at www.danr.sd.gov. Would love to have a bunch of our producers and people interested in agriculture show up to attend that free event with us.
That is South Dakota Secretary of Agriculture and Natural Resources Hunter Roberts here on National Ag Day. After the break, we get to know a South Dakota rancher who is featured in a new book called From the Ground Up. It is about women revolutionizing regenerative agriculture. That's next on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new book from Stephanie Anderson called From the Ground Up introduces readers to the women redesigning our food systems. Every chapter shines a spotlight on a different female ag producer, including a chapter about South Dakotan Kelsey Scott. She's with DX Beef, a direct-to-consumer regenerative beef company in the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation. She's also a Lakota Sioux tribal member. I connected with her over the phone. We talked about the lessons that Mother Nature has embedded into her existence and what it means to challenge the norms of our food production.
As farmers and ranchers, there's so many unique realities that we're working to navigate every day. Many of them are so recent in the evolution of society, you know, like having appropriate access to credit and knowing when all of the deadlines are at the USDA office and getting access to that office. I mean, there's a long list of these kind of deadlines that, you know, more recent society has imposed upon farmers and ranchers. And then plus we're also, you know, working off-farm jobs to be able to support the bottom line. We have families, we have kids in school, we're on the school board. You know, we're an active member of rural communities, and we all know how hard in South Dakota, we know how hard it is to make rural communities thrive. We work towards it every day. But because of all of those things, I think it's really easy for us to get distracted from the lessons that Mother Nature has just embedded in her existence. And there's so much we can learn from natural cycles and the ecosystem that surrounds us. And because of all of those production system realities that we're navigating, I think we kind of get this adopted mindset that we're supposed to work against systems because systems are typically working against us. Mm. And so we make decisions to work harder against the natural systems, wherein if we have a few, you know, cascading things fall into place for us on the financing within the community, you know, having a support system, having a mentorship network that we can learn from, it starts to become a lot easier to look at nature, to learn from nature, and to actually figure out how to have your production system mimic the nature that it exists in. And to me, that's a lot of what celebrating food systems, revitalization efforts that are happening right now. We're coming into these regenerative ag or whatever the, you know, buzzword for defining working with nature is now. Yeah. And we're celebrating it like it's something new, which is great. It's worth being celebrated, but it's only going to be somewhat superficial in our appreciation for it and our adoption of it if we don't recognize that those are systems of production that existed on this continent before. They've existed worldwide before, really. And we have a lot more that we can learn from the communities that helped to steward these ecosystems into the production capacity that was at some of its, you know, highest level of production in the past.
Yeah. I want to talk about disturbance because that's the chapter that you're in the book. But first, just tell us, for people who aren't familiar with your operation, tell us about what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. My family and I run a cow-calf operation. We have a direct-to-consumer grass-fed beef business where we source our livestock for that business right from our cow-calf herd. We prioritize disposition first in all things. Our livestock, our horses, our people. We really appreciate, you know, an approach where There's an appreciation for not needing to be nervous or scared as you walk through your cow herd. When we go out to check our cows, we want to see the cows running towards us instead of away from us. And so we really think that there's a lot to being able to engage in a production system that celebrates disturbance and appreciates that our ecosystem here, especially within the Northern Great Plains, does demand some amount of disturbance in order for the regrowth to happen. And, you know, we're coming out of a pretty easy winter for the most part, but winter is the best educator for us of that reality. We have a down period in our production, a cold period, frigid blizzards usually throughout the winter, which disturbs the production cycle so that the regrowth in the spring can happen. And so in our production system, we're constantly trying to mimic, you know, the large cloven-hooved bison herds that grazed across the prairie. We're appreciating what wildfires had in an impact in the ecosystem. We're recognizing that beavers helped to increase the water table and working to try to welcome back an environment where our beavers and our muskrats and our wildlife can thrive, and learning that each of these animals, even though we may have forgotten what the role is that they play in the system, they played a very distinct role in the system, and we can learn from what that role is and work to adopt and shape our management of our cow-calf herd and our production practices to celebrate that.
Yeah. I want to go back a little bit. Did you say we prioritize disposition?
Yeah.
I think I know what you mean because of what you said immediately after that, but I want to know what you mean by prioritized disposition.
So we consistently say that we're a family first operation. Above all else, we want to have an operation where our family feels welcome. They feel a part of it. And, you know, family by our terms, you know, you come to the ranch once as a stranger, and you know, you're welcomed back as family the next time. And so I think that in order for us to have a production operation where we, you know, we have family that actually wants to come help us work cows, you know, you need to have cows that are docile, they're tame, they are curious, and they want to be around you.
Yeah.
You know, my grandfather's horse herd, which, you know, we still have in production on the ranch today, he very much so prioritized disposition over color, over, you know, all of the things that oftentimes a lot of people can be focused on in their production capacities. And so for us too, you know, if we have, you know, we got to keep all of our heifers home to try to replenish our herd this past winter. And every single day we're my husband and my two-year-old are down in with the heifers, making sure that they're demonstrating that they're, you know, gentle and down. They want to be around you. They don't run to the next pen over when you come into the corral. They actually come trotting over towards you because they want to see what you're doing. And we cull specifically for animals that do not meet that high quality, docile disposition. We only want to keep those genetics and that inclination thriving in our herd. And because of that, it seems like so much more has gotten easy within our production system.
Yeah.
It's less stress on my husband and I. You know, we're not worried about having to go get the cows in on our own because the cows come running in when they see that we got the gates open, as odd as that seems. But
wow.
It really lightens some of the mental, emotional, and physical stress in production. And it is something that, you know, like I said, we really celebrate that here.
Yeah. And you move them a lot because you don't want them just grazing in one place. Tell us a little bit about some of the ways that you take care of the soil health.
So we're consistently working on developing our cross fencing and water access infrastructure so that we can have smaller parcels of land grazed at one time with, you know, usually we have one large consolidated herd that we're grazing through our pastures. The intention behind having that focused disturbance within one smaller paddock of land or pasture of land is so that we can emphasize the rest and recovery period everywhere else on the land base. And that allows for our native grass system to really pop and thrive and demonstrate its ability to regrow after the disturbance. So in addition to our cross fencing, you know, not every piece or parcel of land in South Dakota or across the country and across the world for that matter can be easily dissected and cross fenced. So there are a few other things that we do to try to emphasize where we locate the disturbance of our animals' hooves. So in the wintertime when we are feeding hay, which is very actually seldom because we really try to prioritize grazing throughout the winter, we specifically pick where we will feed the hay based on where we are seeing from what the land is telling us that disturbance would be a positive impact for that system. And so we'll roll out the hay, you know, on a gumbo flat or, you know, a piece of land that maybe doesn't have a lot of biological matter and could really benefit from cows, you know, depositing some of that hay that we feed and working it into the soil with their hoof impact, doing some natural fertilizing out there. We do the same thing with intentionally deciding where we will locate our mineral and salt locations. So we move them around very regularly and frequently because we know the cows will travel to them. And while they're standing there getting their mineral and salt consumed, you know, they're going to be depositing natural fertilizer. They're going to be working their hoof action on the soil surface. And that's going to help with when you do it right, it can actually really help with compaction issues. It can create little tiny hoof-sized dams where the water can pool and you can really see some grass regrowth start to take off as the system allows for it. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we've done in the past is we have fed seed through our mineral. And so there's a particular parcel of land near our house that we're working to try to rejuvenate. And we know that the animals are basically working as a little tiny no-till drill for us by depositing some of that seed through their feces out onto the landscape. And we're seeing some of those species become more prevalent. And we're distinctly picking species that are, you know, well accepted and welcomed within the system, right? And also help to round out the mineral needs of our animals so that hopefully one day, you know, we have such a variety in biodiversity within our grazable forage that their reliance or their need for supplemental minerals can decrease and they can actually go explore the salad bar of minerals that are growing in the forbs and grasses that are existing naturally within our pastures.
Yeah. How did you learn? Which is a big question because obviously you have a bachelor's and a master's and a life on the land. So how did you learn what, you know? But when you look back at some of the big lessons that you learned about listening to Mother Nature that maybe you didn't pick up in the classroom, what mm-hmm. stands out to you if someone on an airplane just said, how did you learn how to do that? How would you respond?
Yeah, I think the most important lesson in this entire learning journey was appreciating that I don't know it all, right? And oftentimes, like you might complete a degree and you might have learned from one of the, you know, most skilled professors at a certain institution or, you know, whatever the accomplishment is that we think, you know, we should strive for to learn it all. But then appreciating that you still don't know it all and you still have so much to learn and constantly having that, you know, hunger and the drive to want to learn more and to question what you are learning, right? There's actually some things that I learned, you know, 10 years ago in some of my classes that were supposed to be centered around natural resource management and grazing production systems that we challenge those every day in some of our production systems, you know, because I think we're continually learning and our education systems can only educate as fast as they can evolve. And sometimes that's kind of slow. And I truly do believe that a lot of the learning does happen out of the classroom. There's a lot that is gained from being in the classroom, but being out there on the land and being willing to know that you don't know it all, and that helps to train your eye to observe what's happening around you and to question why nature is making it happen that way and to learn from some of the outcomes of it happening in that way.
Yeah. Well, we can use that in our own backyards.
Yeah,
that's really
absolutely
fantastic advice. This is a book about women and people of color in regenerative ag. And there's a lovely part where Stephanie just kind of highlights some of the women who have come alongside you and that you have learned from in different ways, even though they might have not considered themselves ranchers. Tell me a little bit about the women in your family and the impact they have had on the land and the operation.
I think that there's something very special that women in agriculture can connect to in a way that oftentimes men just don't have the opportunity to learn from in their own experiences. I mean, like, there are many different things that I learned from all of the women in my life, from my mom to my grandmas, just in their level of care that they extended and in their welcoming nature. And it wasn't always that, it wasn't ever actually that my, you know, Grandma Regina was out there on the land fixing fence, showing me how to use the leverage of, you know, as a female, how to use leverage different than my grandfather. But it was the care and the appreciation that she put into every pot of coffee and every meal that she prepared for whoever came onto the ranch, and the welcoming nature, right? And, you know, the same goes for my mom and for the other women. There's a unique level of not being able to do something in the same physical manner because, you know, our hips are where our center of gravity is rather than our shoulders, or, you know, whatever it is that has created to a need to think differently about how a ranch task gets done. Yeah. That I think drives this unique, you know, solutions oriented critical thought process that helps to complement a family ranching system, or, you know, even a corporate ranching system. We're seeing an increased number of women in ranching systems becoming key decision makers and being looked to as thought leaders. And I think it's because there's an appreciation for, especially when an opportunity is presented, which I'm very fortunate that, you know, the generations before me welcomed me back to the ranch, and they wanted to hear about my systems challenging ideas, and they wanted to learn alongside of me, and they welcomed me in that way. And I think that, you know, for the most part, a lot of what we've learned so far since I've returned has all been up and up. You know, I'm sure there's a few mistakes that I've made, or a few roundabout ways that I've taken us in some of our approaches, but really just having an appreciation myself for the ways that my husband, my father, my brother, all of the men on the ranch see me as an equal partner, and they see me as a decision leader on the operation and appreciating the ideas that I have.
For the consumers, for the people who are your customers, but who have decided mm-hmm. that they want to know exactly where their beef is coming from and they want it to come from you, what difference does it make to them? What are they telling you about once they make that decision?
You know, I've had a few people share with me their appreciation for taste, a few people that have their appreciation for knowing where their food dollar's going, mm-hmm. you know, some people having an appreciation for the fact that they know their food dollar is supporting conservation-friendly food production. By and large, though, what I feel is actually present in every type of consumer feedback is that they appreciate the ability to celebrate relationship with their food. They have a kinship to the food that they are serving their family. And there's a culture there, right, that gets to be appreciated when they sit down at the dinner table. It's not just, you know, a package of hamburger they found at the supermarket, not knowing where it was sourced from. It's that they remember the face of who was doing the delivery that day for DX Beef when they picked up that product. And so I think that whether they're sourcing that product from me locally or from another producer locally, there's a common thread in what's driving consumers to gain their access to food at that local level again. And to me, I think it's the celebration of relationship and how that is such a critical part of what makes our community here.
That was Kelsey Scott, owner of DX Beef. She's featured in a new book from Stephanie Anderson. You've heard Stephanie Anderson on our program before. This latest book is called From the Ground Up, and it is about the women revolutionizing regenerative agriculture. We'll take a break. When we come back, Laura Rohde is with us. We're going to talk about the future farmers of America this National Ag Day. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Plenty of South Dakotans have a connection to FFA. The Future Farmers of America program has been a major part of the spirit of South Dakota's youth and agriculture for more than 95 years. This International Ag Week, I sat down with South Dakota agricultural journalist Laura Rohde and Wyatt DeYoung, South Dakota's FFA Executive Secretary.
Well, my current role with South Dakota FFA is that I'm the executive secretary, which I'm one of three state staff positions that essentially works for putting logistics for event planning, whether that be competitive events, awards and applications, leadership planning, conferences, things of that nature. I get the great task of being able to work both with the ag teachers and FFA advisors across the state, as well as with their students directly. I get to work with the state officer team. We have six state officers that we get to elect every year. I get to work pretty closely with them, although they're not my primary focus. But then I also get to really look at what can we do at the state programming level to ensure that we're meeting our mission statement, right, of helping our students develop premier leadership, personal growth, and career success through agriculture education. My role historically, I was fortunate enough to be an ag teacher and FFA advisor in Winter, South Dakota, where I was there for 4 years, teaching mostly agri-science courses. Formerly, I was also got to work as a trainer through National FFA, got to travel around working with state officer teams, worked really closely with the National or the New Century Farmer Program, rather, which is really to develop students' passion to go back to production agriculture. I think one of the things that I absolutely love about FFA is that the opportunities for student development is just truly remarkable. I also do love, though, that we do have programming tried and true to what the organization was originally developed for when it comes to the production agricultural students wanting to go back to the farm and ranch specifically. And that's always been a fun project of mine, especially, you know, that's something I always wanted to do growing up on a family ranch, third generation, and now very excited that my own personal fourth generation just started. So we just had our first little one here the end of December of this last year. And so that's just been a lot of joy to be able to watch the FFA programs truly develop in my role, you know, keeping tried and true what keeps South Dakota FFA strong, but then also trying to develop those opportunities for enhanced learning experiences for our students, because we've grown so much as a state. And so South Dakota FFA, we are just over 6,500 FFA members now in 112 chapters across South Dakota. And that includes our very first truly homeschooling-based FFA chapter as well, which has kind of been a fun undertaking.
You just made that job sound really fun.
Yeah.
Like everything, you know, about your job sounds fun, which means you are have a passion for it. That's what I'm, because I would not be qualified to do any of that. But your passion shines through is what I'm trying to say.
Thank you, Laura. I appreciate that.
Did you start with FFA when you were younger, too?
I did. So when I was a freshman, the way we had it structured, because I know we have a lot of chapters that now have actually about a third of our chapters in South Dakota have an offering for seventh and or eighth grade. We didn't have that growing up. And so when I first started my freshman year, getting the introduction to agriculture, food, natural resources class didn't really fit into my schedule really, really well. And so my mom at the time, she knew that FFA would open a lot of doors for me, as it did for especially her siblings growing up, and she saw that. And so we worked with the school and my FFA advisor to be able to get an independent study course for me that first year, because obviously with FFA, the unique thing for participation is that we're so strongly tied to the classroom piece, right? So in order to be an FFA member, you have to have that at least one semester of agriculture education. And so I started out my freshman year and didn't really know exactly what the program could offer. I knew that I loved livestock judging. I loved cattle and I loved livestock judging, and that's what I wanted to do. And that one experience kind of opened the doors into several others, and meeting not just my own ag teacher, but other ag teachers that really stepped in and provided some neat guidance and wisdom for me. And some challenges to see what is it that I really could do, both from a leadership standpoint, as well as my own operation here, raising cattle. And I know Lori Tonak, I know a lot of people know her across the state. She was an advisor in Kimball, South Dakota for several years. And she really challenged me to push harder than what I was in terms of my involvement, both in the ranch and then also in the agriculture industry at large.
So, Wyatt, I remember being on the nominating committee, and it's been so fun to watch you and other FFA members grow into their passion for their careers and agriculture. FFA is the reason why I'm a communicator. When I was a freshman FFA member, I competed in the Creed Speaking Contest, which is one of the first leadership development contests a lot of youth participate in, and I won a district contest. And so the local newspaper interviewed me, and they said, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, well, I was thinking about journalism. And they said, did you know you could become an agriculture journalist? And so from that moment on, freshman in high school, I knew I was going to go to SDSU, major in agriculture journalism. And truly, I've had a fantastic career where I get to talk to farmers, ranchers, agribusiness people every day.
Yeah.
And what's really cool is a lot of them have stories like Wyatt does and like I do, where our roots come back to Future Farmers of America or FFA.
Yeah.
So it's
okay.
Pretty cool.
So where are you from?
So I am an alumni of the Newell FFA chapter, so
okay.
Western South Dakota near Sturgis. And okay.
And then you went to SDSU.
Then I went to SDSU, agriculture journalism, and then in 2020, I graduated a second time from SDSU, this time with my master's in mass comm. And so now I get to teach the next gen, which is really fun.
All right. I mentioned the jacket, so you have to tell people about the jacket.
Okay.
Yes.
So
on radio, so you have to describe it.
So the official dress of the FFA is a blue corduroy jacket, and on the back there is the FFA emblem, which is an ear of corn with an owl and a plow and a sunrise and an eagle. And what's really special about the FFA jacket that I got as a state FFA reporter in 1998, or the FFA jacket that my FFA advisor got in the 80s, or the FFA jacket that the first national officers wore in the 20s, is they're all the same. And they're made from blue corduroy. And what I love about the FFA jacket is it doesn't matter how much money you come from. When you go to an FFA competition, you look like everyone else. It really puts you on an equal playing field. And, you know, as a teenager, you're already really nervous about livestock judging or public speaking or ag mechanics. And you don't have to wonder what to wear. You can just put on your blue corduroy jacket and you're ready to go.
How far back, let's talk a little history, does FFA go? And how revolutionary was it to begin this idea of ag education versus reading, writing, and arithmetic, right?
So it's pretty amazing. In South Dakota, we actually will be celebrating 100 years of FFA in 2028. So FFA goes back a little further than that in some other states, but in South Dakota, 1928. Mm-hmm. And what's really cool is, like agriculture, FFA has evolved. So what started as an opportunity to teach farm boys leadership and technical education grew and expanded to include women, pretty awesome. And then today, you don't have to be a farm kid. In fact, the majority of FFA members aren't, because agriculture has opportunities for all students. And recently, an FFA chapter started at the Career and Technical Academy in Sioux Falls. Mm. So it's fantastic how, as the industry of agriculture has evolved, so has the FFA organization, which actually is the nation's largest youth-led leadership organization, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit, Wyatt, about that leadership development piece, because you come back to that again and again and again. And what's at the core of that? What are you hoping to do for young people in the leadership development realm?
Similar to how in the agriculture industry, it's been very focused on how do you develop yourself to really push yourself to overcome challenges and meet the needs of a growing population from a food standpoint, especially. That's so ingrained in the heart of what FFA does from a programming standpoint, because, you know, when you think about leadership development and the times that we as individuals have gained the most in terms of our confidence moving forward, it's rarely in a standpoint of us just getting information and doing something with the information, right? It's about working through it yourself, making decisions, and unfortunately making a lot of wrong decisions, mm-hmm. but at the same time challenging those standpoints of what we believe and how we can grow that. So I love the model that FFA has in terms of being a student-led organization. We have, of course, have guidance and wisdom from multitude of stakeholders and ag teachers as mentors. But when it really boils down to it, there's a certain amount of ownership that goes into the programming and planning standpoint. Even at the state level, we work a lot with our state officers, our state ambassadors, our district officers, chapter leaders as well, from a student standpoint to really see, okay, what is our passions? What are we wanting to see? How can we grow different areas of experiences for our members? And the neatest thing about it is that when we really focus on the aspect of being student-led, I think that idea puts a lot of extremes in our mind, right? It's like, give the keys to the kid and let them learn how to drive on their own. Well, that's not quite what we're talking about either, right? But being student-led is the students putting in the work to realize what leadership truly means and that it is hard work. I think this is really exemplified in what we do from a programming standpoint in what's called the National Chapter Program. It's a program developed over many years of taking the best practices of our chapters, of our ag teachers, and the best results of our students stepping up within their communities, because I love the mindset of thinking globally but acting locally. And I think when we can get our students to see the big picture but act so intentional at the local level, it's so important, because that national chapter application, it takes into account what a chapter does over a 12-month period. It looks at all of their programming. How are they meeting the needs of their individual members and growing that leadership, right? Mm-hmm. How are they helping the needs of their community to build strong communities? And how are they strengthening agriculture within what they're doing, whether that be ag literacy type events, whether that be outreach events to understand farm safety or the, you know, resources that communities need. And so it's all about helping our students engage with the challenges that they see within their local community, connecting them with resources from a bigger scale standpoint, and then how are you going to make change at the local level? Because I think ultimately, if we can grow members that know, one, how to identify a problem, do the research, and then two, how do you actually institute change that lasts and makes a positive impact at the local level? That's how we grow leaders in the FFA.
That was Laura Rohde, South Dakota agricultural journalist, and Wyatt DeYoung, South Dakota's FFA executive secretary. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.